to DR Oshkosh and WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. U.S. military ships have established a perimeter as they try to recover debris from the water off South Carolina. It's where the Chinese balloon was shot down by an air-to-air missile Saturday in what China called an overreaction. ABC's Britt Clennett has more from Hong Kong.
According to U.S. officials, these kinds of balloons have been a tracked passing over the U.S. in recent years on multiple occasions, but it's not clear how frequently or what their purpose was. There have been spotted all over other countries, too, that China has a strategic interest in, including the Philippines and reportedly India, too.
4 out of 10 Americans in a new ABC News Washington Post poll say they're worse off financially than they were when President Biden took office. In the race for the White House in 2024, Americans for Prosperity, a political organization founded by the conservative Koch brothers, says it's prepared to support a presidential candidate who, quote, represents a new chapter. This is ABC News. Former president of Pakistan Pervez Musharraf died at 79 while living in exile in Dubai. He was best known for leading Pakistan to help the U.S. during the war on terror after the 9/11 attacks. California Friday announced it would end its plan to require COVID-19 vaccines for public school students in the state. Its emergency declaration expires later this month, but conspiracy theories around vaccines continue to grow, especially online.
The phrase "died suddenly" is routinely used in obituaries, news reports, and on GoFundMe pages, but now anti-vaccine activists are seizing on it to flood social media with suggestions that those sudden deaths were the result of COVID vaccines. Users have been affixing the hashtag "died suddenly" and a syringe emoji to stories ranging from a 6-year-old girl who died in Ohio, even though she really had lifelong health problems, to an actress who died, but it was due to a bacterial infection, and to a Brazilian TV host who collapsed on air, but that was due to a heart condition, and he's actually still alive. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Brian Clark, ABC News.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
4 Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. After decades of losses, the population of rural America is growing again. The Journal of Rural Sociology says 1/3 of non-metro counties have gained population since the pandemic. Sarah Malott is a data journalist for the Daily Yonder. She says rural counties where recreational activities drive the local economy are growing the fastest.
So people then associate these places with a higher quality of life.
If trends continue, Malott says the population of rural America could grow by 1.3% by 2030.
That's actually 23% higher than the projected urban rate.
Other rural communities have found novel ways to attract people to live and work. Anya Stepien has more on that.
The first decade of the 2000s was not kind to Newton, Iowa. The appliance company Maytag was bought out, and when their headquarters closed, 2,000 jobs went with it. Then the housing bubble burst. When no new building permits were issued in 2011, Bruce Showalter, the housing director for the Newton Housing Development Corporation, knew the town was in trouble.
If you're not building new houses or upgrading your housing stock, then you're dying. So if we didn't do something, the city was going to just deteriorate and continue to lose population.
So Newton created a new housing initiative, which provides a $10,000 cash incentive to anyone building a home worth $190,000, as well as a subscription to the local newspaper and a YMCA membership. In the past 9 years, more than 100 homes have been built, helping grow Newton's economy as well as its population.
Half of those houses have been sold to new people moving to town. So we're actually drawing people to town because of this program.
More than 50 other rural communities offer incentives, from free building lots and cash payments to complimentary dinners and internet credits. I'm Anya Slepian.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold, 1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003. 125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW and on the Civic Media app.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season, from clipping your horse for competition season to keeping the backyard birds well-fed season. And of course, loving your pets like family season. There's a reason people say, if Fleet Farm doesn't have it, you don't need it. Because we have it all. Fleet Farm. Built for real life.
The Devil's Advocates.
Mitch McConnell did make a public statement, right? After he voted to acquit,
though nothing says the president can't be prosecuted,
set the example for your caucus.
Convince your caucus as to why the man is not fit to serve. How do you not use your leadership to say, you guys, this is crazy. We can't do this, and here is exactly why. Because now of the two major political parties, one of them is under the thumb of a fascist insurrectionist.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
From Green Bay to Oshkosh and Point South, wherever you are in the Fox Valley, count on us to keep you connected, informed, and entertained. Civic Media.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Attorney Fred Gordon, and former alderman in the city of Milwaukee, who now resides in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're talking about, you know, it's Black History Month, so I reached out to Fred because, you know, some things that happened in the city of Milwaukee that I think that many people in this listening audience would be amazed to find out, you know. And so we're going to be doing that throughout this month, bringing people like Fred Gordon on to talk about the history of this state and Black people in it. And before we go back, Fred, you know, what we want people to understand, too, is back during those times, we kind of had our own Bull Connor, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Harold Breyer and that police
Harold
department.
Harold Breyer was the chief of police, and he ran a very tight ship, as they used to say back in the day, in the sense that you had a small number of African Americans, and I don't think they had any Latin people on the force during that time. And he ran the city. I remember vividly during those times when the mayor, Henry Meyer, said emphatically that there's nothing that I can do to stop Harold Breyer from doing what he does.
Right.
And, you know, that was an admission that was very shocking at the time. And essentially, he ruled the city, and certainly the segregation that was pronounced at that time was due in large part to the control that the police exercised over the African-American community, and in many communities still existing here at this point in time in America.
Yeah, so let's go back to the open housing. And the fact that, you know, schools, the schools that were created to address this, the segregation in the schools.
Yes, well, what happened, Earl, is, as you may recall as well, is that from 1965 to 1967, there was a lot of activism. There were marches, there were boycotts, there were sit-ins. The NAACP, and more importantly, the NAACP Youth Council, spearheaded what was, as I indicated earlier, called direct action. Instead of just complaining about it and crying about it, the determination was to get into the streets, to march. We were taking our cues from what we saw happening in other cities around the country, particularly in the South. Dr. King came to Milwaukee during that period of time.
Several times.
Yes. Dick Gregory was very much involved in helping to publicize what was going on and certainly marched with us. You know, I was like 13, 14, 15 years old. And the youth council at that time was spearheaded by Father James Grappi. And, you know, as you know, during that period, there was a coalition of activists, black and white, who were working together to bring attention, you know, to these segregated situations in America. And the Catholic Church was very much involved at that time in leading that. Father Grappi, as we called him, marched with us, organized, and spearheaded the resistance to the laws that were being perpetrated upon the African-American community, and the fact that, for the most part, all black people lived in one area of the city. And that's why the open housing, the fair housing laws that were being put forth by then Alderwoman Bill Phillips and others were contentious, because essentially they wanted to keep black folks in our place. And as long as we stayed in our place and did what we were told, then we wouldn't have any problems. But obviously that wasn't the case. So in 1966, I recall vividly, the marches had started to ramp up. And, you know, I was a kid. I got involved because the NAACP Youth Council Freedom House was right behind where I used to live. And I spent a lot of time over there and got involved and got to marching. That's where my political consciousness began. And, you know, as a teenager, you know, I was reading James Baldwin and, you know, Dr. King's speeches, and all kinds of activity were going on. So the marches across the 6th Street Viaduct was the first time that I had ever marched. You know,
Fred,
in a civil rights march.
I know, but so Fred, before we get to the viaduct, what people need to understand is the viaduct was like a dividing line.
Yes.
White.
Yes, the viaduct was.
Go ahead.
The viaducts, and there was more than one too. The viaduct separated, you know, the black community from the white community. It separated the north side, where most black folks live, from the south side, where most white folks live during that period of time.
Right.
So no black people ever crossed the viaduct unless they were going to work or, you know, had some business over there, and very few black folks had business on the south side. So as a result, the viaduct was the dividing line. So to march across the viaduct was a big deal. And marches were organized and commenced, and there were several marches. There were marches every day, as I recall. And every time we got to a certain point, there was resistance, you know, by white people who did not want us, quote, invading, unquote, their neighborhoods.
So, Fred, people might want to know, were these marches just with black people, and how large were they?
Oh, no, they were not just solely black folk. During that period of time, as you recall, Earl, integration was starting to proliferate. We always had the opportunity to coalesce with like-minded white people.
Right.
There weren't a lot of them, but there were some. And as a result, we did have white marches. And again, I have to give the church at that time credit, because Father Grappi was the leader. You know, think about this. You know, we had a white priest who was leading the black struggle.
Yes.
At that time.
Yes.
And as a result, you know, there were other priests, Lutheran priests, Catholic priests in other cities that were doing the same thing. So that's what focused the attention of the world, really, on the city of Milwaukee, that you had this white priest who was leading these black folks on marches across the viaduct to City Hall and downtown Milwaukee. And as a result, Milwaukee became an epicenter of the struggle.
So Fred,
and the attention was being brought to bear you know, on the conditions in the city.
So, Fred, hang on a second. Let's go to the phone lines and Andy from Beaver Dam. Hey, good morning, Andy. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Well, I moved to Milwaukee in 65 from my hometown, and everything you're describing is right. The Father Grappi would lead every day a group of African Americans and other people over the 16th Viaduct Bridge over the Menominee River Valley into the Polish, what used to be the Polish section of Milwaukee. And of course, these guys over there, the white guys, they'd be waiting for him, and they would, this was a peaceful demonstration. But a lot of times those guys would, you know, throw rocks at him or, you know, or just, they'd really get mad, you know, at the demonstrators and get them crazy. As far as Breyer was concerned, you know, cops in the mid-60s always looked like, you know, they'd have the hats and all that stuff. Though that everything crescendoed by 67 after the riots when they closed the city down, all of a sudden the cops are wearing helmets and riot gear, and they'd open up the doors of their police cars and they'd have shotguns stuck in a holster in the door. I mean, they were totally armed, you know, ready, hell-bent for whatever would come their way, you know, and like you said, Breyer would rule with an iron hand. He was the guy, you know. I mean, I don't think he had a whole lot of use for the African-American community, you know. He was a hardliner, you know, but it was definitely a time of change and revolution and whatever, and everybody, you know, wanted to be able to, you know, live wherever they wanted to go. They wanted to be kept to one sector of the city, you know.
Hey, Andy.
Would be my observation.
Hey, Andy, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. Fred?
The result, it was very exciting for a young person like myself, because I was becoming aware of who I was as a black person. I was reading, and I remember vividly that when I joined the NAACP Youth Council, and, you know, some of my friends, a lot of my friends were also involved, the marches were a major thing. It was being covered by, you know, the networks, because as we were talking the other day, there were only three television networks in existence at that time. So, as a result, you had a lot of attention being brought to bear on the city of Milwaukee. Because at that time, Earl, as you know, the city of Milwaukee was, you know, it was a Polish-German populated city,
right,
with a very small African-American community. You know, black folks came to Milwaukee after the Great Migration in the late 50s. So it was one of the last cities to have an influx of African-American folks from the South to come up for the jobs, because at that time there were many, many jobs that were available to people. So as the caller was saying, the white folks would throw rocks and bricks and epithets at us and would charge us when we marched across the viaduct. So it's funny now, because they would literally run us back across the viaduct to Wisconsin Avenue.
So, Fred, because we unfortunately, we got to go to a break again quickly. But one would probably ask, what were the police doing during this time? Were they protecting the people coming across the viaduct who were enforcing their constitutional rights?
Oh, that's a whole other discussion that we'll have after the break.
Okay. All right. Hang on. 844-967-2789. Attorney Fred Gordon's on the line. We'll be right back.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's